Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
David's 5-day preliminary hearing didn't just build the murder case. It exposed what Celeste Rivas' own parents allegedly knew and what they actually signed off on. A lot of it we've been speculating about for quite some time now. And turns out it looks like we were probably pretty right. A notarized London travel form, a Vegas trip with her sister along for the ride, David sitting in the family's church pew, all entered into evidence while her father's attorney maintained he'd never had contact with the singer. Defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis is with us today on whether the adults who were supposed to protect Celeste face legal exposure of their own. We're going to talk about that lane of things first, then we're going to talk about all of the other stuff that David is now facing that have come out in those preliminary hearings where the judge, spoiler alert, said, yes, you're going to trial. Robin is off today on a speaking engagement, so it's you and me, Eric. We're kicking it old school. Let's start by talking about the parents here a little bit. Detective Farrell testified that the family knew David attended their church, he says. The sister went to Vegas with them, and the parents signed a notarized form letting their 13-year-old fly to London with a grown man. These are all the allegations under California's child endangerment statute. Isn't that exactly what permitting a child to be placed in a dangerous situation looks like? You tell me.
You know, it's certainly a fair question. Most folks would not think to allow one of their minor children to go with a strange adult, you know, overseas and things like that, on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, you look at cases like Michael Jackson, and David is a far cry from Michael Jackson.
Yes.
I'm not equating the two. But, Michael Jackson, some people let their children hang out with Michael Jackson. He's a star. Oh, there must be security around, right? Oh, it must be safe, right? And those assumptions don't always hold.
That's a really interesting point. It's a lot of, well, there must be, it must be, dot, dot, dot. And you put that guard down, I guess. Well, some people do anyway. People who maybe are not super aware or, I don't know, experienced in the world. I don't know. There might be some barrier here. I know they are immigrants. Celeste, I believe, is the first generation in the country. If we're looking at it from that perspective, this is not something that's necessarily completely unheard of, I mean, people and celebrities, and when celebrities, some celebrities that seem to have a penchant for children have been known to do this. R. Kelly, Michael Jackson, the list goes on and on. Elvis Presley, the list goes on and on. What's going through their mind, do you think, at that moment in time when the adult in the room says, I'd like to take your 13-year-old on this trip? Is it, wow, what an opportunity. We can't afford her this. Let's let this grown-ass man take my 13-year-old across the world with him. Nothing could possibly be going on here. He just wants to give her a great experience. Are people that stupid?
I think it's easy for folks to be blinded by sort of the glamour of it all or something, and that can cause them to not accurately discern the risks that also might be attendant to an event like that. You know, like I said, this famous person, they're a celebrity. And I think there's kind of a notion that, oh, wouldn't it be great if my kid can experience this? Like you said, they might not be able to experience it otherwise. And then, oh, what about these risks? What about these concerns? What about these dangers? Well, let's sort of not give much attention to those things, because this is a really cool opportunity for our kiddo, isn't it? I'm just wondering if that's part of the thought process.
It does make you wonder. I mean, at the moment in time, David did not have any charges against him. There was no criminal history. He had a lot of macabre music, and that was kind of about it. And there was a huge age difference. If we were to look at something like Michael Jackson and a case like that, in situations there, there was a track record. There was a history. There was allegations anyway. At least nothing that was solidified in court. But certainly there were hearings, there were trials, and people still, even said, "Well, you can go hang out with my kid," and they looked the other way. Back at that point in time, we just looked at Michael Jackson as the bad guy. We didn't necessarily look super closely at the parents at that point in time. Was that a mistake? Why do you think we look at this differently today? Why are we more quick to judge the parents than we were 20 years ago with Michael Jackson for putting children in harm's way?
Tony, I think there's been sort of a trend towards exploring parental responsibility for horrible things that happen, including crimes. You know, we look at school shootings, for example. Back in the day, there was no chance that the parents would be charged criminally or anything like that. And now, recently, parents have been charged and, in fact, convicted in part for their involvement in the acts of their own children. And so, I think we're sort of looking at that more critically and determining, hey, should these parents, do they have a legal duty to be the custodians of these children, to care for these children? And if they screw that up too badly and something horrible happens, should the parents be on the hook a little bit as well? I think we're moving in that direction.
Yeah, I think we are too. So there's the argument here that he's trying to make. I had no idea. Celeste's father told TMZ through his attorney in May that he'd never had any contact with this guy. Well, Detective Farrell said the opposite under oath. If the father told investigators the same story during the missing persons reports that he didn't know Burke, while his own signature sat on a notarized London travel form, if that's true, that's what they brought into court, that's not an embarrassment. Is that obstruction?
Generally speaking, you can't lie to police. Making a false statement to a police officer is usually a crime on the state level, at least. And so I think that can be problematic. If a person knowingly was deceptive to a police officer in a way that impaired an investigation or threw the police in a different direction or something of that nature, that could rise to the level of obstruction. Although I think they'd have to establish really like a culpable mind state for the person who gave the knowing false statement. Why did they do that? And so that's a bit of a question mark still, but we're at risk here of criminal liability.
Yeah, I mean, it's starting to really feel like that. I've questioned this from the beginning, just on my gut. Obviously, we haven't had evidence to talk about yet, but now we do. When you have something like this, okay, so let's just rewind a bit. You have Celeste, she's missing. As far as we know publicly, the parents, and I don't know exactly what was said to investigators, so let's caveat it with that. But as far as what we've known publicly, what's been stated is that they didn't know much about David. They knew that their daughter, their 13-year-old, had a boyfriend named David. Okay. But that was it. That was pretty much, it. Your daughter's missing. Your daughter's been murdered. We know that now. Or is dead. We don't quite know if it was a murder officially. But you have all this going on, and you're pretending you don't know the guy that everybody's got a microscope on whose trunks your daughter was found in. That feels more like you're protecting yourself than you're trying to lead investigators down a path of what actually happened to your daughter, because you feel a little guilty about being such a dumbass by letting her be with the guy in the first place. That's my conjecture on it. What's yours?
Yeah, you know, that seems pretty darn reasonable in terms of an interpretation, because, yeah, when these things happen, I remember watching the Michael Jackson documentary, and they're talking to parents of children who really let their children hang out with Michael Jackson, and some bad stuff allegedly happened. And the parents are pretty, you know, ashamed, and they feel guilty, and it's embarrassing for them. And they, you know, explain their reasoning at the time. But I can understand how Celeste's parents may share some of those feelings under these circumstances, that, gosh, could I have done more? Did I make a stupid call by letting my kid go with this adult? And especially when you have sort of the magnifying glass of the national media on you, I could see where a person might not want to admit that. But if that impulse to not admit that causes you to knowingly give a false statement to police who are investigating the death of your daughter, I think that's problematic. I don't think that that's something we can just write off as understandable. Oh, these parents were going through a lot. Sure they were, but you can't lie to police, especially if it's going to hurt the case that's trying to seek justice for your dead daughter.
Yeah, I mean, I want to have as much empathy as I can for someone who's lost a child. I cannot imagine going through it. I pray to God I never have to go through that, because I cannot imagine the feeling of what that is like. I've seen many people in my life who've had to go through that, and they're never whole ever again. So I try to have some empathy there, but at the same point, when you're actively seemingly, some may take it as impeding an investigation because you don't want the spotlight shown on your bad choices, you know, as being part of how the recipe made this. That's pretty sick. The parents reported Celeste missing multiple times in 2024. They took her phone. Burke allegedly paid a classmate $1,000 to deliver a replacement. So maybe they're sitting there going, what the hell did we get ourselves into? How did we, you know, maybe we shouldn't have been so generous with our daughter's time or our time or our allowing him to be with her. I don't know. Maybe they're sitting there going, this was a bad idea, but how do we back this down now? They knew that she kept going back to this man. Keep in mind, she's 13. My daughter is 13. It is not an impossibility to keep your child restrained at home if you need to. That is not an impossibility. I don't restrain my child at home. I don't have fears of these sort of things. But they're 13. They're not jumping in the car and running across town on a whim. And then they signed a travel form so she could go across the ocean with the same guy. At what point does reporting your daughter missing and then handing her over and her passport over to the guy cross from negligent into facilitating?
Sure. I mean, you know, you want to think about the knowledge that the parents may have had of the risks when they gave the authorizations that they allegedly did. You know, it's got to be a difficult position for those parents. And I think, you know, if you have, especially if you have a child who is perhaps acting out, I'm not saying Celeste was doing that, but generally speaking, if you did, it might be difficult to control that person. Not impossible. You like you mentioned, you certainly could. But on the flip side, you shouldn't be, like you said, facilitating, encouraging, helping, aiding in those sorts of activities for whatever reason. And if you do, you're sort of inserting yourself in terms of your involvement, what you've authorized, and what comes with the consequences of that may, you know, legally, ethically, or otherwise, be on your shoulders, at least to a degree. And I'm not trying to blame the parents for the death of Celeste, but I'm just saying, when talking about why things happen and what we can do differently, these are important questions.
Very important questions. Do you think that there is a case here where there could be charges brought against the parents at some point, or is this one of those chapters in this story that kind of lives in a gray area at the end of the day, where yeah, they were not good choices, they were irresponsible, they were ignorant. I mean, lying, if it turns out that they did know a lot about this relationship and then lied to investigators, That's something. But we don't know if that's what occurred. That has to be, you know, parsed out here in court. But other than that, being an idiot parent isn't necessary, unless you are the one that's causing the harm directly to your child, isn't necessarily a crime. There's horrific parents everywhere that keep their children. Where do you think this goes, if anywhere, with any sort of, you know, criminal culpability for the parents in this case?
Sure. So knowingly making a false statement to police is a crime. And saying, oh, I was distraught, or oh, I was trying to protect my family, or any of those reasons are not defenses. And so by the letter of the law, that may be a crime. When it comes to child endangerment, permitting your child to be in a dangerous situation, usually there has to be a temporal connection to that permission and some injury to your child. And I'm wondering if they would be able to argue, hey, regardless of the permission, it's not as if this thing happened, you know, during the London trip or during some trip that I authorized. So, and then lastly, I think that even if by the letter of the law, there was something criminal that happened, I imagine authorities would say, hey, these are grieving parents who have lost their child in a horrific fashion. They may have made a misstep, but we're not going to go after them for it. That's kind of what I think.
Yeah, I mean, what a misstep. I mean, it is something they will live with for the rest of their lives. And ignorance has consequences. And they are facing them now, without a doubt. Whether it goes beyond that, I don't know. I guess my concern is that there's other children in the house. But maybe this was it's beyond close call. I mean, it's a collision with the worst that maybe this will be one hell of a cautionary tale to live by, if nothing else. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to work through our conversation about the case of David and Celeste Rivas Hernandez. The evidence prosecutors laid out over 5 days tracks the timeline from the first online messages when Celeste was 11 to the inflatable pool in the garage and the body in the Tesla. The judge heard it all and ruled the people met their burden on every count. And David now faces a trial with special circumstances that put the death penalty on the table. Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor, is with us to help us break it down. Robin has the day off. Prosecutors mapped a 21-minute window. Celeste's Uber arrived at 10:10 p.m. Her phone went permanently silent short after. The next morning, Burke sat for her radio interview about his album, then allegedly started ordering chainsaws, a body bag, and a burn cage under a fake name. Does that timeline alone get the prosecution to premeditation, or do they need the financial motive in this as well to help seal it here?
Few things. I think that timeline certainly gets them to like abuse of a corpse or covering up a murder or something like that. But when it comes to premeditation for the killing of Celeste, that is a little more debatable, I think. And you know, certainly there are some precursors, but I think that motive is going to loom large once the trial comes, because it makes sense, right? Like if a person is about to be is on the rise and is already a star, might be a mega star at some point. And then, oh my gosh, your underage lover is threatening to ruin your career. And then shortly thereafter, that lover disappears. Certainly, common sense can put together those dots. And that's what the prosecution will be asking the jury to do.
Blair Burke pressed Detective Farrell on Celeste's messages, threats to strangle Burke, to destroy his career, references to harming herself. She also got the medical examiner to say he couldn't definitively rule out that the wounds occurred post-mortem. I mean, is there a self-inflicted death defense here? They were insinuating that could possibly be part of this as well, or is Burke just building a record that she can point to during trial to manufacture reasonable doubt? At the end of the day, that's what they're going for, reasonable doubt. Is there a way that they can get there, that Celeste did this all to herself, and then David reacted in a horrible, horrible horrible way to cover up the relationship and the corpse.
Absolutely. I think the defense is going to go down that route. They're going to say, and they've made statements to the press consistent with this, saying, hey, David did not cause the death and is not guilty of murder. They're going to go in there, I think, and say that this was a very tumultuous situation. It was kind of rapidly escalating. You have this underage romantic partner, criminal victim under those circumstances, and she's threatening to out him. And things just got chaotic and crazy, and she caused the injuries to herself and died. And then David is left with this dead minor's body in his vicinity. And he's saying, what do I do about this? Well, if I call the police, they're going to say, they're going to think I did it. I can't have that. So what's the next course of action? Trying to get rid of the evidence and doing that in a cover up fashion and covering up interfering with a dead body is one charge, but causing the death of another person is a much more serious charge. I think that's the route they're going to take at trial.
Do you think that is where this eventually ends up once this trial actually does get underway, however many years it is down the road, that David is going to basically be admitting to several of the charges, the disposal of the body, the cover up end of this, but not the actual murder itself? If they go down that road, I mean, there's certainly penalties to that. It's not the death penalty. It might not be life in prison. It's certainly going to be some time. It's not just, oh, you overreacted and you didn't go to police to get help. You did all this. Is that going to be the goal? I mean, is that the goal, do you think, at this point when they're with the attorneys for David, of obviously keep him alive, but is it more so damage control than it is you're going to, walk out of here and, drop a new album?
It is not uncommon, Tony, at all at trial when there is significant evidence against the defendant for defense counsel to pursue like a compromise verdict, to go to the jury and be like, hey, look, we're going to be real with you. There's enough evidence on the, cover up the abuse of a corpse charge. Find him guilty of that. But there is not enough evidence that he caused this death. And in fact, he didn't. And you cannot convict him of that. But if that were to occur, one, that abuse of a corpse charge is a felony. It certainly carries prison time, probably significant prison time. And then on top of that, they have the essay on a child charge. And that charge, even though it's not murder, that can carry decades. And so you got to be careful if you're asking for a compromise verdict that you don't ask for too big of a compromise and get dinged on both of those serious charges, in which case he would be looking at decades in prison, even if he beats the murder charge.
Yeah, I mean, there really isn't a gray path here. I mean, do you go in of just, this is all a lie? This is all, I mean, the evidence is damning. I mean, at the very least for the relationship that was going on there. I mean, on the surface it is. I mean, we don't necessarily have, well, actually we do. I forgot. There are the images on his phone. So that's there. So it's damning. It's damning anyway you play this. But juries sometimes when the evidence is somewhat questionable, and if there isn't a litany of other charges that are going to lock the person away for a very long time, sometimes go to the lesser charges, where if the litany of other charges wasn't there, they might just convict on the higher charge, but they'll feel more confident in doing all this. He's gonna serve his time, is kind of the thought process, to not go for the murder one. It's obviously probably a strategy that I'm going to guess the defense of David is taking into account here. Do you think that's the route that everything goes down, and the bet that they're going to try and take with that jury?
I think that's certainly on the table. And I think that, when you're conducting a jury trial, especially as defense counsel, they already kind of see you as a person about whom they should be cautious because, you know, is this guy lying to me? Is are they fabricating some sideshow that's going to try to distract me? And so you got to be real with these jurors. And sometimes that means making concessions. Sometimes that means acknowledging the weight of the evidence for certain charges. And I think in this case, that might make sense because, you know, it'd be a perilous route to go to this jury as defense counsel and say, all these charges are bogus. They don't have any evidence. Why are we even here? We shouldn't even be talking about this. I think you really have to be a little bit more solemn and appreciate the gravity of what some of the apparently undisputable facts could show.
Yeah, I saw some comments. She fell on the knife. Yes, it's the Ellen Greenberg case all over again. But let's talk about it. I mean, just the fact, like the Ellen Greenberg case, the idea that somebody did this to themselves. You know, over there, that never even made it to trial, never made it into a criminal complaint. In this case, obviously, we're there. But the idea that someone would have done this to themselves, I mean, people don't typically do this. People don't typically stab themselves. And from what we understand, that was lookingly what to be the cause of death was of Celeste Rivas Hernandez, was the stab wounds. That's a hard sell, too. I mean, is that what you go with, that she did this to herself? Yes, jury, it's rare, but it happens. And these were, you know, very hyped up young people and very emotional. And she, in a dramatic fashion, took the knife or whatever the hell it was and just started stabbing herself. I mean, can you sell that to a jury? Was that really, really a hard one to try and get them to digest?
Well, I think it's. Very difficult, that we would have to look at a few things. Whether there would be a witness who could testify to that. And, you know, the only two of whom I'm aware are David and Celeste. And Celeste is gone. So does that mean that David would get up there and sort of tell this version of events where Celeste turned this sharp blade on her own 14-year-old body and killed herself? You know, that's going to be met with a lot of suspicion, I think. And then on top of that, my understanding from the autopsy is that there were at least two sharp force wounds that they believe caused Celeste's demise. So she would have had to stab herself multiple times, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think one of them was in the lung that was determined to be the most terminal or something. But a person stabbing themselves multiple times, on the other hand, a 14-year-old doesn't always have access to a gun. They might not have access to other means by which, you know, cyanide pills or something. They might not have access to that stuff. So they might just reach for what they have around them, and that would be a knife.
The three chainsaws is quite a dramatic piece of this story. Three chainsaws recovered from the home. Everyone tested negative for blood, and LAPD never collected them for further testing, which, again, the PI found them and the burn cage that they left at the house. How many inroads did the investigation leave for the defense to try and go down the reasonable doubt category of, well, these are just props for music videos. There's no blood on any of this stuff. You know, he's macabre. You know, he's this, you know, he's that. I mean, I don't understand why they left these chainsaws in the burn cage in the house of the guy they suspected of chopping up a young woman. That seems to be like a no-brainer of like, hey, what evidence do we take? Well, the chainsaws are at the top of the list. The burn cage is number two, but apparently they weren't even on the list. What do you make of that?
Frankly, it's baffling. Baffling why law enforcement would not seize those items that appear central, including based on the information they had at the time, they had a disarticulated minor girl's body inside of a vehicle, and they're searching the house of the person in possession of that vehicle. And you find these instruments by which that disarticulation could occur. I can't fathom why you wouldn't seize those, even if they were tested for blood and tested negative. You know, blood can be removed from an item, but that doesn't mean there wasn't other biological material that could have been at least explored and tried to have been tested for. And so I just don't get why they left those. And certainly the jury's not going to get it either. And then when the defense says, hey, that's, you know, one of 10 errors law enforcement made, on top of the fact that you don't have any witnesses who did this, you don't have the murder weapon, you don't have a significant amount, you start to create some opportunities for defense there.
How strong is the claim that David has of, she told me she was 18. Now everybody's telling me she's 13. I mean, the police did come to his house one day and say, by the way, she's a runaway and she's 13. Is there any, I mean, but there's the notarized affidavit, the you can go travel the world from the parents if she's 18. There's no notarized affidavit. There's no need for a notarized affidavit to allow her to go and travel. But was that, is that something, if that was done behind the scenes and David, let's say, is not aware of how his travel is being coordinated, let's say there's a group of people behind the scenes that are doing that, which in this case there probably is. There's probably handlers that are handling all of that. So somebody would have seen the age of her. Is there any world in which David can argue that he was bamboozled, that she said she was 18 this whole time? Maybe he can even argue that the family played along too. I don't know. But do you see any route where they try to make that argument in court, or was that just a stupid argument that he made when the police came knocking one day?
You know, of course, it's not perfectly analogous, but it reminds me of a situation where let's say that there's a liquor store and somebody comes in, and this person is about 4.5 feet tall, and they have, you know, a Power Ranger shirt on, and they don't have an ID, and they have, you know, they're carrying with them like a toy that they brought with them. And you have all of this indicia of this person being underage. And then when the person tries to buy alcohol, they say, oh no, I'm 21. I don't think that liquor store owner could use that as a defense by saying, well, they told me they were 21. Now, of course, you got to show ID. It's not perfectly analogous, but you see what I'm saying, where you can't just be blind. You can't blind yourself to these obvious facts right in front of your face and then claim you didn't have knowledge of those facts. You did. And knowledge of those facts could lead to a reasonable inference of knowledge that this person was underage. I think that there are similar indicia here when the police are telling you this person's a runaway. Hey, people who are over 18 aren't runaways. That would never happen. Yeah. And so, you know, all of that just doesn't make sense. I don't think that that's going to be a credible position to take.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you can go with there's too many hands in the pot here, and one hand's not talking to the other, and you don't know, and you're just I think it's a stretch. There's a lot of stretches that need to be believed in order for David to be completely unwitting in all of this and just be there one day and, oh my God, she stabbed herself. What do I do now? I mean, I don't know. At the end of the day, it's damning no matter what. Prosecutors are running the murder for financial gain special circumstance play here on this. Burke's former financial manager testified about transferring Texas properties to his mother to shield assets. I think a lot of people wonder about just how shielded that actually is when you do something, when you're moving assets and the motivation behind the moving of those assets. Does the motivation of moving those assets ever play any sort of role when it comes to seizing those sort of assets? Or is this just how it works? If you get it moved quick enough before the law comes calling, you're in the clear. Is there any mechanism that can be looked at here of, okay, he had these assets. The law started looking at him for this. Turns out he did this. If he did, again, he's guilty till, or innocent till proven guilty. But if proven he did, and the family's moving these assets around to protect them from civil liability, whatever it may be, can you ever go back and get those things? Or once they're moved to another name that's not the defendant, are they safe?
Yeah, so I was recently looking at Colorado's version of this law, and most states have it, where you can essentially petition a court to freeze assets to ensure that they are not transferred, ensure that they're not liquidated, and things like that. And the court, in making that determination, looks into the motivation for the attempts to move assets. You know, for example, if a person had was moving assets in anticipation of litigation because they were trying to deprive a claimant of access to those assets. Typically, that's a no-go. You can't do that. And the court will take measures to freeze and or seize those assets. Now, if you have already transferred them before there's any petition to the court, that makes it a little bit more difficult. And there are further analyses in which the court must engage to then say, hey, can we go to this defendant's father who now has, you know, this valuable whatever piece of jewelry and say, hey, that you can't do anything with that. That's got to seize that. That part's a little more questionable. So it depends on when the assets were transferred, when a court was made aware that there could be some funny stuff in terms of asset transfer to deprive a claimant, and also California law and how it handles those things, although I suspect it's the same as Colorado law.
Yeah. I mean, it's money, but obviously at the end of the day, a life is gone. So that's far more important. But you do wonder and you want justice and you don't want people skirting it for their own gain out of horrendous behavior. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversations right there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage of this case as we continue to follow it. Let's move over to another one right now that is going on. Oops, hang on one second. There we go. I clicked the wrong button. It would be this one, Nolan Wells. Bart Edmonston Jr., one of the friends on Horn Island with Nolan Wells on July 4th, just retained attorney Russell Latino, who says Edmonston fully cooperated with investigators, turned over his boat, GPS, and phone, and flatly denies any involvement in Nolan Wells' death. A lot of people online who have already decided what happened here have been naming names and have been accusing him of being involved in the death of his friend. And the murder of his friend is what some are claiming. Latino announced the family is filing defamation lawsuits. We knew this would happen, and I applaud it. They've hired a PI firm to attract social media users and says a credible death threat brought in by the FBI has also has been brought to the FBI, so they're aware of it. The question nobody's asking is whether this legal offensive would even exist if the investigation had given the public a single answer. In those 25 days, Latino comes out swinging categorical denial of any sort of involvement here. Voluntary cooperation on the part of Nolan's friend, the boat and the GPS phone all turned over. The PI firm hired nationwide defamation lawsuits announced. That's not a guy playing defense. He's running offense at this point. Isn't this about establishing that Edmonston has cleared in the court of public opinion before a grand jury gets to weigh in? Is that what this is about? To clear his name with the ether, with the internet, before that all gets underway? What's your take on this? Of filing these suits? We haven't seen them filed yet, but the threats are there. And what do you think the odds are of succeeding? There's been a lot of vile commentary on this about people who were very, very close to Nolan. And if they had nothing to do with this, the last thing you'd probably want to do is file a lawsuit that would open yourself up to civil discovery and all sorts of things. If you have something to hide, it would come out. Why would you be filing a lawsuit if you didn't do anything?
Yeah, I think certainly filing a lawsuit or at least threatening to gives me some indication that this person is either making a tremendous bluff or they believe that they have nothing to hide. And that's kind of consistent with how this person has acted throughout the duration of the investigation. And in terms of the success of the lawsuits, hey, if you can show that a person has made a false statement and that it was a statement of fact, and that it was a statement to the public, and that it's caused you some kind of damages, including having to face death threats that you wouldn't have to face otherwise, then that seems to meet the elements of a defamation claim. Now, whether that claim is really collectible is another issue entirely, but perhaps it doesn't matter to this family whether it's collectible. Perhaps this is an assertion of, mm-hmm. hey, putting myself out there and saying, not only did I have nothing to do with this, but I have been aggrieved by these falsehoods that have been spread about me. And I think that that certainly could influence the public narrative and could potentially influence the grand jury investigation.
Yeah, I mean, you don't typically see people who are guilty filing civil defamation lawsuits that would open up discovery and all that if they have something to hide, because that would backfire tremendously on them. If you're going to file that, I mean, either you're really grandstanding and hoping that nothing will happen, which does not appear to be what's happening here. It appears that there probably is absolutely nothing to hide. Not that I'm aware of, not in a lot of cases we've covered, not to say that this hasn't happened in the legal world, Eric. Have you seen any cases like this where people start firing off, defamation lawsuits? I guess we have seen one in the Koberger case. Someone was accusing a professor of being involved with the murder, and that they won a tremendous amount of money on that one. Are we going to start seeing more of this? And I guess at what point, how do you handle this from a legal standpoint? Because there's creators who get on their pulpit and preach to their masses what they believe, and then the masses seem to go along with it, no matter how off base it may be. And the masses then scatter, and their flying monkeys say what they're going to say, and it just scatters out there. Do you go solely after the creators who are making these proclamations of guilt against people who are innocent and never been charged? I don't want to say innocent until proven guilty. Never been charged, probably never will be charged with anything. Do you go after the people who are making the big claims, or do you go after all the monkeys as well? The whole circus goes down. How do you handle that from a legal standpoint? Because that's a lot of people, a lot of filing. I don't know how it all works on the back end.
Sure. It can be complicated and messy and unsatisfying and perilous at times. You know, it reminds me a little bit of the Alex Jones defamation case where, he was this big influencer at a TV show stating that there was a school shooting. And in fact, it was essentially staged that there were like these actors involved or something. The families of the victims said, "What the F are you talking about?" And sued him and said, "Hey, this is BS." And they won. Well, those folks, in my understanding, have not seen any significant money. Alex Jones, I believe, has sought refuge in bankruptcy and has lost some of his assets. But if you cannot squeeze any compensation out of Alex Jones through that process, you know, how are you going to do that for a person who has 500 followers who's also talking mess about you? If it's not successful against somebody like Alex Jones, I think the likelihood of success against a different type of influencer is even lower. And so, you want to protect your name and you want to assert your interests, but you also don't want to get into some quagmire that could be never ending and you have bankruptcy proceedings on the back end. And how effective really is that process?
Let me ask you your opinion on this, because you're right. We have seen this, in several examples now. I just wasn't seeing that at the beginning. We have seen this run its play, and it hasn't worked well for creators who've made dramatic assertions accusing innocent people of crimes. Has that deterred anything, in your opinion? Do you think we're seeing less of that now because people like Alex Jones have gone down? Because I don't remember who it was. It was some, I don't know, unpopular podcast or whatever that went after the teacher in Idaho and the Koberger case. They saw quite a big repercussion for a very small channel. Has this slowed anybody down from going in those lanes, in your opinion, or is there even more of them now?
If anything, at least in my lay appraisal, there's been an uptick in that kind of stuff. Even since the Alex Jones verdict came down, he lost InfoWars. He lost he lost a lot. You'd think that might deter someone who's trying to build a brand, trying to build a platform, trying to build something to say, oh, maybe I should be a little more cautious. But at least in the content that I've seen, that sort of cautious, reserved, circumscribed type of content, that's not what's going to get them to the place that they want to be for some of these folks. And for some of these folks, that they want to be bombastic. They're going to take risks. They're going to say things that are inflammatory. And I don't think that's had any deterrent effect on those kinds of platforms.
Yeah, it really doesn't feel like it has had a huge effect on a lot of those platforms as far as where people are going and what they'll say or not say. I mean, it's true for anything out there that we talk about, or crimes that are committed. There's the death penalty. Does it necessarily slow down people committing murders? No. Consequences don't always have the actions that you want. But on principle, filing this, even if they know they're not going to collect, on principle, does filing this have any, does it make any influence on a grand jury investigation? Does it have any influence on any sort of criminal investigation when you have the people that would in theory be accused, or at least that the internet is already accusing, coming out and saying, "You're coming at me, I'm coming at you." Does that slow down anything in terms of criminal proceeding, or do they just know there's not going to be any sort of criminal proceeding? Even if they were to come at them for anything, we got nothing to hide. We're already telling you, here's everything we got. Dig all you want. You will find nothing. Does this influence anything in those areas? Because that's where the conspiracy camp is going to go. They're going to say they're doing that for this reason. What would you say to that?
I would say that it's going to have less of an impact on authorities and on law enforcement, but the potential impact on a grand jury, I think, is significant. Because, you know, I put myself in that position. Let's say I'm not a lawyer and I'm just on a grand jury and we're trying to figure it out. We're trying to see if anyone might have any sort of criminal responsibility. And you hear about one potential option, and this person has gone to great lengths to, you know, file in a court a lawsuit of defamation saying, "Hey, any accusations against me regarding this incident are false, and they're so false, in fact, that I'm going to use the legal process to protect myself and to hold accountable those folks who are making those false allegations." If I hear something like that and I'm on a grand jury, it doesn't make me think it's more likely that person did it. If anything, it has the opposite effect. And when we're talking about a number of potential players who could be investigated regarding their possible responsibility, that person doesn't seem very high on the list to be charged to me.
Yeah. What about, obviously, if they're going to file lawsuits against people who are making these sort of claims, you know, I say more power to them. Because we don't have facts, and we've been saying it from the beginning, we just don't know the answers, so you can't go down those sort of roads. But you do have people, Crump, who has, there is no other way around it. He's tweeted out false information. He's tweeted out pictures that weren't what he said he thought they were or portrayed them to be as fact. A party, a pool party that took place prior to the incident. See, he made it off the island. No, he didn't make it off the island. This is from days ago. It's been proven. There's been a lot of things that have been tweeted out that have basically angered the mob, angered lots of people, and incited a lot of people to believe a narrative that is not factual, that no one can say they know the answer to. And he seems to be the head of it. He's representing the family right now. And it just seems to be moment after moment that there's some sort of insinuation going on that the people who were closest to Nolan had some sort of criminal responsibility in his death. I don't know if there's any other way of reading that. We talked about this a little bit last week. Can they file a lawsuit against him? I mean, not just the creators who are talking about it, but let's go right down to the very people, the people that some of these creators are looking at as the source of some of this information. If you're hearing it from the family's attorney, and you believe the family's attorney and you're going down that road and you're reporting what the family's attorney is saying, why not go after the family's attorney and not necessarily the people who are just repeating the information from the family's attorney?
Look, Tony, attorneys have a heightened duty to be truthful and accurate, especially when it comes to public statements being made about cases. This isn't an accountant talking. This isn't someone in some other, you know, a waiter or something discussing what they feel about a case. And that heightened duty is there for a reason. In fact, it's an ethical duty, such that we cannot mislead the public. We cannot engage in false representations, including in things that don't necessarily involve legal cases. So that heightened duty, there is responsibility there. And if you violate that duty, I think you are really putting yourself at risk. As an attorney, I am so horribly careful about what I say in terms, especially in terms of my case, but in terms of anything. And when you begin to get a little reckless, perhaps you get worked up, perhaps you get involved in the fervor, perhaps you got a family who is grieving and they're coming to you every day. What is the answer? Tell us, please. And you're trying to move the ball forward. I understand all that, but you cannot do so in a reckless fashion. You cannot do so in a fashion that injects falsehoods into the public narrative that then causes damages for other people. And if you do that, I think there is the possibility of civil liability for you.
What about being disbarred? I mean, I'm thinking of the photo that he tweeted out of the pool party, which was easily disproven as being not what it was portrayed as. I mean, that's falsehoods. That's just bullshit. I mean, I'm all about find the truth. And certainly Mississippi has a history of shit to look into. But this seems to possibly be the generation and group of kids who said, you know what, we're not playing by those rules anymore. We don't deal with that. We're a very diverse group of friends, and none of that is who we are. And then you have that sort of shit being turned around and thrown out there online as if it is something. It's not like Crump has necessarily named the friends specifically as being the murderers, but it's pretty much walked right up to the line of it with what's been insinuated, in my opinion. Obviously, that's not responsible. That is horrendous behavior, in my opinion, from anyone, no matter what side you're on looking at this. And there shouldn't be sides other than trying to find the damn truth. Has he gone too far in this case? A lot of people are looking at this going, this guy is really pushing the envelope a bit much. Where is the bar? I mean, where is the limit as to how far this guy can push? It's not his first rodeo doing this shit either. He's not Saul Goodman at the end of the mini mall that has no clue what the fuck he's doing when it comes to something like this. He's experienced. He seems to know how far he can push the bar. Has he pushed it too far this round? And can there be repercussions? And where would they come from? Especially if there's no criminal action here. Who files the issues with the Bar Association that says this guy's really, you know, this is not okay?
When it comes to potential attorney misconduct, every state has a regulatory body to which complaints can be filed. And those complaints can be filed by anyone. And if the complaint appears on its face to have reasonable grounds of being justified, and that regulatory body can start an investigation. And when it comes to that line, Tony, usually a lot of times what the state bar is looking at is the difference between carelessness and deliberate deception. Certainly, if there was deliberate deception that was proven, that could result in suspension, if not revocation of someone's license to practice law. Proven, that's pretty tough. It would be pretty hard because when you look at some inaccurate information that's been presented by an attorney, and that attorney is like, hey, I had a bunch of cases, I was busy, I accidentally tweeted this. There are so many excuses that they can give that are different than deliberate deception. But a cumulative effect of ongoing carelessness, ongoing negligence in terms of being inaccurate to the public about legal cases that you're handling, I think the bar would look at that in a very concerning fashion.
Is there ever anybody, I mean, I don't know how this works, but like, is there ever like anything in the regulatory agencies for attorneys when they see behavior like this going on, where somebody reaches out and says, hey, you're kind of getting close to crossing a line. Some may already said you have. Or is it just like, nope, here's the consequences. We've determined you've crossed the line. Is there ever the friendly like warning that comes up? Hey, you might want to dial it back a bit because we don't want to have to go down this road with you. Or is that non-existent?
I've never seen where like an Office of Attorney Regulation like gives a warning to somebody and says, hey, let me give you a call, bro.
Just time so
you
out.
We're getting close to that line, dude. You better cool out. I've never seen that. And in fact, the opposite in Colorado, where I primarily practice, the opposite can happen. There's an ethical duty for all lawyers that if you become aware of some knowing ethical violation from some other attorney, technically you're duty bound to report that to attorney regulation. And so there can actually be the opposite where nobody's giving you a warning. And in fact, other folks are ethically obligated to tell the body about your alleged misconduct.
Are there any incentives for anybody around an attorney that might be acting like this to report to the regulatory agency? Or is that like a, you know, a blacklist type sentence where it's like, I'm going to report you, but then, you know, good luck me getting a job anywhere else or with any other any other firm?
That's really the concern, Tony, is that Ben Crump, of his stature, especially within his practice area, it's nationwide. He's a tremendous deal. And so, could Johnny Law student or who just graduated or whatever want to report on that person, knowing the consequences professionally that they might face and also the lawfare that they might be subjected to, even if they're correct and even if they're not doing anything wrong? Yeah. I think there's truly a disincentive to report that kind of misconduct. Might be an incentive on behalf of Crump's team, his company, his other attorneys who work with him, to go to him in private and say, hey, dude, if you get suspended, this company is going to have a tremendous problem because you can't practice law anymore for a period of time. So in order for the viability of the firm to remain, let's be a little more measured on how we're handling this.
From a professional standpoint, do you feel like he's wading into those waters, or is that just me giving the conjecture of a layperson out here going, this seems a bit much?
You know, I look at it in comparison to other cases. So Tony Busby is this attorney who represented a lot of the alleged victims in the Diddy case. And, I think there was more than 100 of those people who came forward. Just statistically, are all of those cases meritorious? Statistically, that would tell us probably not. And he has made some reaches and some leaps and some unsupported inferences in the eyes of some. And that dude's still practicing. And so I'm not sure where that line would rest on this type of behavior. I don't know how close he's getting. And if it's never reported and the regulation body never looks into it, we're never going to know exactly where that line is. We have guidance in terms of what the ethical rules are. But where that line really falls in this context, I think, is a bit unclear.
Is this a story that goes beyond the Nolan Wells case here, but is this an area, and we're just talking conjecture here, of a place where there should be more restrictions? Maybe there should be more more repercussions. Maybe it's an area where there's guidelines, there's suggestions. We've learned in our world, there's all sorts of guidelines and suggestions. There's just not always repercussions if people choose not to follow them, or not very convincing repercussions that someone says, yeah, I can deal with that repercussion. It's not going to, the payoff over here is greater than what that repercussion will be. Does there need to be greater repercussions in this area of law for attorneys that go really too far? Do we have too many out there that are going too far because they know they can, because there really isn't any, there's never going to be enough pushback, and Joe Public talking about it doesn't really mean jack shit to them? Should there be more like that? I mean, obviously there's a yin and a yang to all this, and if you have that, you know, you have it in other places too, so it would have to be applied across the board, not just to cases you agree with specifically. What's your thoughts there? Are the rules too loose and fast, if you will?
You know, perhaps I'm a bit biased because I am an attorney and bring cases to the media and I do talk about
them. Sure.
But, you know, on the one hand, we want to ensure ethical, responsible conduct by lawyers, that they're not being reckless with their statements, especially in a way that could be causing harm to mm-hmm. other people and an impairment of certain investigations. On the other hand, there is free speech. A person's allowed to have an opinion. That's different than stating a fact. If an attorney is stating an opinion about something, that's a little more protected. And gosh, if we go to grand jury proceedings and someone is ultimately charged and that finding is consistent in part with what Trump has been saying, that then I think a lot of folks would be like, oh, hey, we should let these folks pop off. We should let them push the envelope. We should let them be suggestive because sometimes it leads to a greater truth. And of course, that end would be in hindsight, and that would justify it under those circumstances. But if no one is charged in the grand jury proceeding, then it just appears to be recklessness. And I'm not sure. I think we got to be careful about circumscribing the speech of anybody. But we also can't just let lawlessness abound and people get hurt too. I don't have a good answer for you.
No. I mean, I respect that. It's always fascinating to see what's going on, behind the curtain and to get your insight into it. Fascinating conversation today, as always. Thank you so much, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, for being with us and giving us your insight on where these cases stand right now. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching so you don't miss any of our conversations. Until next time, for Robin, for Todd, for Eric, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.